John Adams knew he was making history, but it sent shivers down his spine. A bustling little lawyer from Boston confided to his diary,
"The objects before me are too grand and multifarious for my comprehension. We have not men fit for the times. We are deficient in genius, in education, in travel, in fortune, in everything. I feel unutterable anxiety."
Successive British governments had tried to cover the escalating costs of their huge North American empire by unilaterally imposing new taxes on the colonies. In Boston, where Adams had been one of the leaders of resistance, the protests had pushed Britain to impose martial law. Now, in September 1774, a Congress of delegates representing all the American colonies was convening in Philadelphia to discuss a concerted response. Despite his anxieties, Adams sensed the portentousness of this continental Congress.
"It is to be a school of political prophets, I suppose, a nursery of American statesmen. From this fountain may there issue streams which shall gladden all the cities and towns in North America forever."
In the end, Adams's hopes proved more justified than his doubts. The generation he feared was deficient in everything became the Founding Fathers, whose names are now part of American mythology. The months they spent together in Philadelphia, engaged in passionate debate or chatting in taverns, not only schooled them in statecraft, but also helped to make them American, forging a sense of unity among men from Massachusetts and Virginia, from New York and South Carolina, who'd often never set foot in each other's homeland. But in 1774, the Continental Congress still wasn't ready for a total break with Britain, opting instead for a ban on British imports, in the hope this would persuade the king to accept its basic demand of no taxation without representation. And some in London were keen to compromise. The MP and political theorist Edmund Burke urged the Commons to treat the colonials as they would treat free Englishmen.
"Magnanimity in politics is not seldom the truest wisdom, and a great empire and little minds go ill together. In America, our ancestors have turned a savage wilderness into a glorious empire, not by destroying, but by promoting the wealth, the number, the happiness of the human race. Let us get an American revenue as we have got an American empire. English privileges have made it all that it is. English privileges alone will make it all that it can be."
Burke wanted to give American colonists the privilege of seats in the British Parliament, but his motion was rejected by a majority of 4-1. Most MPs wanted to teach the Americans a lesson. Early on April the 19th, 1775, a force of British soldiers from Boston marched into the village of Lexington in search of illegal arms and ammunition. Facing them on the green were some 70 members of the local militia. The British infantry, with their red coats, white breeches, and brown Bess muskets, were a frightening sight in the chilly dawn. One militiaman whispered,
"There are so few of us. It is folly to stand here."
Major John Pitcairn, the British commander, rode up to them and shouted,
"Lay down your arms, you damned rebels, and disperse!"
The militiamen began to leave the green, carrying their muskets. That wasn't enough for Pitcairn.
"Damn you! Why don't you lay down your arms?"
Another officer cried,
"Damn them! We will have them!"
What happened next isn't clear. Americans said a British officer fired, the British blamed the Americans. But a shot did ring out, and then a British officer cried,
"Fire, by God, fire!"
One of the British platoons let off a volley. Pitcairn shouted to stop, but before he could make himself heard, a second volley exploded. A few of the militia shot back, and then the redcoats charged. Within a minute or so, 8 of the Americans were dead and 10 wounded. The British pressed on to nearby Concord, but they failed to find any hidden arms. All along the road back to Boston, some 16 miles, they were harried by militiamen, firing from behind trees or walls, and sometimes fighting hand to hand, hatchet or club against bayonet. When the exhausted redcoats struggled into Boston that evening, 70 had been killed and 200 wounded. The skirmishes at Lexington and Concord were followed by a full-scale battle a couple of months later in June 1775, when British troops attacked Patriots fortifying Bunker Hill north of Boston. The British cleared the hill, but lost 250 men in the process. General Thomas Gage, the British commander, previously confident that a firm hand would slap down the revolt, now advised London,
"The rebels are not the despicable rabble too many have supposed them to be. The conquest of this country is not easy."
For its part, the Continental Congress sent militia companies from Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia to reinforce what it now called the American Army encircling Boston. The American colonists weren't up in arms just about taxes and troops. There were other issues as well. The British Parliament had allowed freedom of worship up in Quebec, a largely Catholic colony recently won from France, and this alarmed the fiercely Protestant people of New England. And in 1775, when the governor of Virginia was trying to control the growing insurrection there, he offered to free those slaves who joined his troops and fought against their masters. In a colony where 40% of the population was black, nothing could have done more to alienate the whites. To American patriots, the British seemed to be engaged in a systematic conspiracy to undermine their liberties and their religion. But moderates still reckoned it was the fault of a few malevolent ministers whom the king might be persuaded to sack. And they worried that a war with Britain could be won only with the help of France, the old enemy who'd just been kicked out of America at great cost. It was all very frustrating for John Adams, the Boston lawyer who was leading the radicals in the Continental Congress. He wrote home,
"Every day we sit, the more we are convinced that the designs against us are hostile and sanguinary, and that nothing but fortitude and vigor and perseverance can save us. But America is a great unwieldy body. Its progress must be slow. It is like a coach and six. The swiftest horses must be slackened and the slowest quickened, that all may keep an even pace."
To crack the whip, radicals urged local counties and towns to send resolutions in favour of independence to Philadelphia. Nearly 100 such messages arrived during the spring of 1776, from Massachusetts to South Carolina, and this increased the pressure. On June the 7th, Adams and the radicals, judging the moment right, brought a motion to the Continental Congress. It was passed, and Congress then set up a committee to draft a formal Declaration of Independence. Adams was one of the committee members, but the principal author of the declaration was Thomas Jefferson, a delegate from Virginia, because Adams didn't want the notorious hotheads of Massachusetts to be seen to be taking the lead. Here was the start of an intense relationship between Adams and Jefferson, one that would shape American history for the next quarter century, as it swung from friendship to enmity and eventually back to friendship again. They were an unlikely pair. Jefferson was 33, 7 years younger than Adams, and his lean, lanky frame towered over the portly Bostonian. As a spendthrift southern planter with thousands of acres and dozens of slaves, he offended some of Adams' most cherished Puritan principles. What made him ideal to draft the Declaration of Independence were his encyclopedic knowledge and his fluent pen. Philadelphia in summer was hot and smelly. Despite the mosquitoes and the horseflies, Jefferson worked in his lodgings with the windows open. On his lap was a small folding desk, one of his many ingenious designs. He began his declaration from the familiar starting point of radicals in Britain and America, that all governments were based on an implied contract between the rulers and the ruled. But his elegant preamble, scarcely altered by the Congress, set out these ideas in words that have echoed down the centuries.
"We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government.
From these first principles, Jefferson's declaration then turned to the American case, seeking to show how
the history of the present king of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states.
Jefferson listed 21 examples of such tyrannical behavior. Some of his charges were vague or flimsy, but at their heart were the familiar stories of taxation without representation, the imposition of military rule, and most recently, the use of brute force. Jefferson built up to an angry conclusion about the barbarities of the slave trade, claiming that King George III
has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred right of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither.
The idea that George III had foisted the slave trade on Virginians was, of course, preposterous. Jefferson was tying himself in knots, trying to justify slave owning in a declaration about the right of all men to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Prudently, the Continental Congress cut the whole contorted passage. But Jefferson's dilemma, how to throw off British slavery while retaining slaveholding at home, was one that the founders of the new nation never solved. After an impassioned speech from John Adams, on July the 4th, the Continental Congress approved the amended Declaration of Independence. This was then printed in newspapers and read out in the streets, often accompanied by 13 cannon shots, to symbolise the fact that 13 British colonies had become 13 independent states. John Adams wrote to his family back in Boston,
"I am well aware of the toil and blood and treasure that it will cost us to maintain this declaration and support and defend these states. Yet through all the gloom, I can see the rays of ravishing light and glory. I can see that posterity will triumph in that day's transaction, even although we should rue it, which I trust in God we shall not."
John Adams was a perpetual worrier. Posterity would indeed glory in America's Declaration of Independence. Its words would be imitated by freedom fighters around the world, and its architects, Jefferson and Adams, would eventually become presidents of their country. But, as Adams recognized, independence didn't come for free. First of all, they would have to win a war.